G'day everybody, it is the VH Sleuth Podcast, back for a new year 2021. We weren't really away really, we were here last week, but it's a new year, it's a new opportunity to talk about motorsport of all sorts. It is episode 87 of our VH Sleuth Podcast. I'm Aaron Noonan, Will Dale is across from me. Happy New Year, Will. It's the same podcast and nothing much else to change.
But thank goodness it's no longer 2020.
Oh, that was a shiver. That was an absolute stinker. Hopefully 2021 is bigger and better for everyone in the world than 2020, which was pretty bad for most people. It was probably still okay for some, but not very good for others. Anyway, let's drive on into 2021. And we thought we'd start with an episode for the year where we look back at a category or a style of racing that doesn't exist in Australia, sadly, anymore. But I've got an idea on how we could get it back. But that's for a bit later on. Oscar, NASCAR, Thunderdome. When you think of summer motorsport of the 90s, Thunderdome and NASCAR racing was all the rage.
Summer, even now, is traditionally a speedway season for motorsport on dirt, on short ovals. As we've discussed in previous podcasts, that was my first motorsport event was Thunderdome at the end of 94 under lights when all the Americans rolled in. But I've been watching it for years before that.
Yeah, when the lights came on. Was that the first one under lights?
No, it was the first year, but they'd done the last round of the previous summer season.
Right, and that stepped it up. The under lights thing was huge when the Thunderdome went under lights because it became...
It's World Series cricket.
Yeah, yeah. They call it, you know, they talk about Saturday night at the skids with speedway racing. It's been under lights for years.
Be there,
absolutely. The thing was that when NASCAR Oscar did it, it really tweaked it up a little bit. So we wanted to take a look back and pay homage to Australian NASCAR and Oscar racing because whenever we do content that relates, and we haven't done a great deal of it, but any content on our website or on the pod that relates to or discusses that style and era of racing, we get a lot of really great feedback. And the fact is it's basically 20 years now since Thunderdome Racing sort of wound up with, I think it was the last race was like 2000 or somewhere, very early
on
2000.
On the Dome.
Yeah. And, of course, the NASCARs as they were continued on as stock cars in the Power Tour. Remember that with the super trucks? It ran for a couple of years, but it wasn't under, obviously, Bob Jayne's control or it was its own separate thing. So, I mean, it's a world... First, NASCAR racing in Australia. The first major NASCAR race outside North America was here. And you drive past the Calder Park Thunderdome, which is in a state of disrepair.
Time is not, 20 years have not been kind to the Thunderdome.
No. It's looking very haggard. And you look back and you go, oh, wow, that was massive what Bob Jayne and all those involved did to build that track, to put on something that was you know, and we'll talk about this, but I think he was a bit ahead of his time, really, with a lot of the things he did with that style of racing. But think back to the early 1988. February 88 was the first NASCAR race on the Dome. It had been used as the link track for some touring car racing the previous year, but the first NASCAR race was February 88. So you had Bobby Allison, the late Neil Bonnet. You had
Dave Marcus,
who was a regular runner. Michael Waltrip, a future two-time Daytona 500 winner. This was before he'd really won anything. Aussies, Alan Grice, Dick Johnson, a bunch of no-names from America that no one here knew, but they were from the lower categories of NASCAR.
The Winston West Tour, all Californians.
Yeah, all that sort of stuff. And it really struck a chord with people. This was something new. It was different. And I think it's the late 80s. So we were in a period of, particularly in motor racing, but of life and world, Crocodile Dundee to America, internationalism at its finest. You know, we had America's Cup would have been won in 83 and defended or lost in 87. you had the ability to take touring cars worldwide, take your Commodore to Europe and Europeans to come here into New Zealand. It felt like the gates of possibility were open for motor racing, and that's what we got with Thunderdome. And for basically a decade, it turned on and NASCAR Oscar raced beyond the Dome, but it really turned on and became its own motorsport scene within the scene. It employed a lot of people. It gave a lot of sponsors opportunities to run in front of crowds and on TV. And it brought a style of racing we'd not had here before. And I think as an experience, as a fan, it was tasty because it fit the perfect T20 cricket style window. Saturday night, 7 o'clock till 11 or whenever the curfew cutoff was. You'd get all your racing, you'd get a NASCAR race, an Oscar race,
You'd sportsman. Probably get two of each because yeah, they'd split them in half, yeah, do 50 lappers. Later on,
yeah. You'd get a HQ crash with some racing around it. you'd get the legends on the pit apron. You got a bit of everything. And as a show and as a bang for your buck, it was really good.
And it was a treat as an Australian motorsport like fan. You'd see the whole track. If you sat up in the stands, you could see everything that was happening. Mm. There wasn't like the cars disappearing into Dunlop Loop. If something was going on, you just could had to hear be right, and just look.
You had to look at the right
away.
Place at the right time to see the crash or the pass unfolding. But one thing that I said here before we did this podcast, and do you reckon Bob Jayne was before his time with NASCAR and Oscar racing? I've got a feeling that it's commonly said, and I think it's right. Once touring, it took advantage of touring car racing's failings. There was a waning bit of interest, and people are golden. Think about the golden era of Group A. It wasn't that golden in a lot of instances.
No.
But wasn't it great variety and it was competitive? No.
There was variety up to a point till everyone realized,
didn't mean everyone was in it.
Yeah.
It could win.
I need this car to win. I'm going to go get one of those cars.
So turbocharged cars were the norm. Commodore was struggling. Falcon was gone. So this came along at the right time in the late 80s, early 90s when that was all happening to put – okay, it wasn't Holden's and Ford's, but it was in Oscar. And that was a smart move, creating Oscar, by the way, because it had that connectivity to the local audience.
It was the savior for, like, if Bob Jayne and Calder Park hadn't created Oscar, I don't think NASCAR would have been successful anywhere near the extent it was, because you needed that local link. And it was something distinctively Australian because they were going the other way.
Yeah, we like to be a little bit different, don't we? But big fields, Oscar blew up real quick. Like it was 30 plus cars. NASCAR took a while to get going and probably it never got to the same fields and heights. Some of those big money races in summer where the Americans would come out had a bit more oomph in them. But it came along at a time where people loved the V8 concept, close competition. You could see all the track. It was new. It was fresh. It was different. I reckon if you picked it up and moved it along the timeline to maybe another 10 years forward, Marcus Ambrose been to America, internationalism of NASCAR. I mean, it was for so many years. I mean, if you were from California, you're an outsider, but let alone another country. But
you're
then
not
you
American.
Had,
you're not really anything, Terry Hogg said.
Yeah, exactly. I knew where that came from.
Oh, it's going to be the first of many.
Yeah. Montoya got in. And
Dario.
Came there. Dario had a crack, didn't go so well. Villeneuve had a bit of a wheel in there. Blokes were jumping from IndyCars because the money was really good. It became this place, and then, you know, there's been Mexican involvement in NASCAR, and they went to Canada, and, you know, it started to just grow and grow and grow, and it was an option for a racing driver who wasn't American to still maybe do some form of NASCAR racing. It was doable. I mean, Marcus did it from
and did it
awesomely well, made it through the three tiers and got to the point where he won races in Cup, albeit, road courses, but he still won at the top tier of the sport.
Top three at Bristol is very hard to do.
Yeah, he would have loved to have won on an oval. That would have been the crowning glory. But I just feel like Bob was a bit ahead of his time, and the 5-litre V8 thing certainly took away a little bit of the lure. But I reckon you've got to look at it all in perspective. So what was the biggest asset of Thunderdome and NASCAR and Oscar? Bob Jayne, I reckon, you got to say. He funded it. He had the dream. He went and made it happen. People thought he was nuts. What was the biggest negative of it? Was it maybe him as well? In that over time, did he not employ the right people to run it? Did they not look far enough in front? Did they not have the best commercial people to get the best television deal? Because once that started to go, went from Channel 7 in the start, in the early 90s, then it was on SBS, which was great coverage if you're a hardcore. Harder for a sponsor to sell that.
Well, up in North Queensland in Bowen, we didn't get SBS until 2003.
So NASCAR Oscar didn't exist for you in the mid-90s.
Wasn't a thing, unfortunately, yeah.
Yeah, and then it ended up with delayed one-hour cut-together shows on Channel 10 with NASCAR and Oscar, and then
which admittedly was part of their suite of motorsport programming
on
Sunday
afternoon.
It was,
but it wasn't a priority. It was a low-fruit-hanging thing. Yeah. But the racing was still good. There were still good names. There were still great cars. But I can't help but feel that you watch where it ended up and the television exposure slipped away. And once that starts to slip and you can't get a hold of that, you're in trouble. And I felt like that's where it happened. V8 Supercars was rising. and really starting to take off with Evesco and really laying the groundwork for taking over things and squashing anything that kind of got in its way. And the point, I mean, just the money, the sheer money that Bob J must have tipped into that place over the years. I'm sure that people in his business, advisors and like said, this is not good. You're spending too much. This can't keep going. But no matter what you think of Bob Jane or what he did or he didn't do in the sport as a driver, as a car owner, you got to dip your lid to the bloke for what he did for this period of Australian motor racing. Because for a time there, it wasn't just the Thunderdome.
No.
I mean, Australian Grand Prix at Calder brought out the big names, circuit racing, world touring cars, oval racing, drag racing.
Yeah.
Calder Park, I mean, the tagline, remember, in the 90s was the centre of Australian motorsport. And it was pretty true.
Pretty spot on.
Had pretty much everything going on. I mean, location-wise there, whether you were coming from Ballarat or Bendigo or Melbourne, perfect. And NASCAR and OSCAR became the thing that was the signature for that place.
Well, they didn't have touring car racing at that time.
No, they had a big gap, didn't they?
Because Bob had signed a sponsorship deal with Vic Health, which precluded tobacco advertising of any kind.
So 10 years. It was like, no, it was about 8 years between rounds, so 88 to 96.
Yeah. And that basically ended any touring car racing there because, of course, Benson Hedges, Peter Jackson, all these tobacco sponsors. In terms of whether it was before its time, I just don't see how it could have worked any better if you time shift it forward 10 to 15 years. If anything, like their window was closing. When it arrived, as soon as touring car racing got its act together and realized, this isn't working,
we've got to go that way.
Poland versus Ford. It basically took away the core thing that helped NASCAR and OSCAR gain a foothold, which was V8 powered Holden versus Ford, Ford versus GM. It was loud. It was exciting to watch. Suddenly, touring car racing had that back again. And as you said, V8 supercars was on the massive rise and was squashing everything around it. There's no way they would have allowed an alternate form of racing that would have been a threat to them to prosper as much as NASCAR did when it was in the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, it's a hypothetical really on what, where, why and how, but yeah, and you'd have to speak. It'd be interesting to speak to some of the people who were car owners, who were drivers, for their take on it. But, you know, I remember so many people telling me the prize money was so good that you couldn't ignore going and competing there, because if you did good for what you spent to build a car, run a car for a season, you could actually come out, and plus whatever sponsorship money you grabbed, you could actually come out in a pretty handy place. So
especially in the years when it was on Channel 7 and there was good TV to entice the sponsors on board. And when you look at what the rest of the landscape looked like in Australian motorsport at the time in terms of prize money and television, it was a really good deal.
Oh, and their TV pack, like they had live races in the 7 era and even that on that evening, which was virtually the same as what touring car racing was getting. So they were comparative television package from my recollection of that period. It was one of those things, I think, the NASCAR, OSCAR racing, it was different. Anything different, fresh, new, oh, let's have a taste of this. This is cool. But it built its own super speedway fraternity and world. People that were from circuit racing that came and did it because they went bang for the bucks, really good. John Faulkner, a good example. When OSCAR racing, I think he hired a Steve Harrington car and thought, this is great. I think it was in a shunt that first one or something.
Yes, he was.
But he ended up, you know, a regular in OSCAR and then in NASCAR. And so many people made that development jump. Brad Jones obviously was the 5-time OSCAR champion and went NASCAR and won that title as well. Jimmy Richards did racing in both. You know, Terry Wyhoon stepped it up. He won the OSCAR title and then he went into NASCAR and was a front runner there. Matty White did the same, won Oscar, went to NASCAR. Then there was all the one-offs that people, you know, Russell Ingall racing at Bathurst. Everyone forgets he won the 98 100K Saturday race for Scotty Williams in that Chevy Monte Carlo that Kevin Schwantz had previously driven. It attracted some big names, but they were all sort of one-off, almost promo ones in a way, like
Greg Murphy, absolutely. I think everyone forgets that he raced a NASCAR on an oval.
A few times,
Peter Brock probably headlines that list.
Yeah, he did an OSCAR race first in a Falcon in 88 when he was driving the BMs. XF Falcon Mobile OSCAR. I think he was running all right. I think he got towards the front with Jim Richards, who was his BM teammate, And then the thing, I think it dropped the motor or something. And
keeping in mind that was the year where the XF Falcon had a 351.
Yeah, and they went to 302 later on, didn't they?
When they went to the EAs, which was a bit more balanced with the Commodores.
Yeah, and he was entered to run a NASCAR race, I think, end of that year at the Christmas race.
$1 million race.
Yeah, but I think he practiced.
Lunched a couple of engines and
he just wasn't that into it and it wasn't his bag and he didn't start the race. So,
and people forget that another touring car driver that was down for that but didn't make the start was Wyn Percy.
Yeah, he was on the scene a bit through Les Small, who was running Alan Grice's cars. And I think Wyn did have a run in
at the Moomba meeting the next year.
Remember that they, at a time there, they made this big splash with that first NASCAR race in February 88. But the local NASCAR field was pretty small because all the Americans took their cars and they left. A handful of them had been built here out at Calder with John Shepard and his team, and some other people imported cars, but there were still not many. So they had virtually Oscar was the thing that boomed in the big fields, but then NASCAR would have maybe 8 cars, maybe 7, maybe 10, maybe 6. And instead of running a, 300K race or whatever it was, remember they had the lightning strikes.
Yeah.
They were like short, sharp, 6-lap races or 10 laps or 8 laps, and they'd have 4 or 5 or 6 of them in a day. It's the way to run a race meeting when you don't have many cars. Short, sharp, get them off, get them on, keep them rolling, and away they went. But the thing that struck out in my mind, and we talked about, and we've positioned this around the Thunderdome, which is obviously it was the centerpiece of Australian NASCAR, Oscar, stock car racing. But they built a schedule that if you look on it, and if this thing had kept going, it was pretty solid. So, yeah, you could do some Thunderdome races in summer. Yeah.
Yep.
You could race on the Calder flat track, which they did a few times. Oran Park under lights on the short track that they did in the early mid-90s.
Was very good.
Was very good in that SBS era. They went to Eastern Creek on the short track as well before the touring cars ran on the short track. And I think it rained in practice. And therefore, the Australian NASCARs were the first ever to run on wet weather tyres. I've got a funny recollection that
they definitely were. Because I know they had them ready for a Gold Coast event.
And didn't need them.
But didn't use them.
And so, I think they're the ones that they used to run that.
So when Richo went to Japan a few years later, he was fine.
Yeah, yeah. So, there's another thing about NASCAR history. Jim Richards going to race at Suzuka and running really, really well.
Yeah.
They raced at the Gold Coast. Yes. Remember that, when Indy started, there was poo fights over the whole sanctioning of it all, and and FISA were threatening things. And so NASCAR Oscar was a staple part of the diet there from, 91 till 95?
Yeah. Bob Jane just rolled up and said, don't worry, I've got some support categories for you.
Yeah, yeah, I've got a sanctioning body.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing. Remember that he had so many blues with cams that in the end he just went, stuff it. We're going to set up our own sanctioning body. Oscar Racing was the sanctioning body for Oscar NASCAR racing, not cams. So
with a licensing deal with NASCAR, from memory?
And he did, but I think that lapsed somewhere in the mid-90s from
which
my
memory.
Which
is why they went back to being stock cars.
Yeah, that's right. I think it was still colloquially called NASCAR. But for a time there, they called them AC Delco Cup cars.
That's the one I was looking for.
And they were the Strathfield National Cars, which was the Oscars, which I thought was weird because I would have presumed they were allowed to use the term Oscar because they owned it, but
maybe it was too similar.
Yeah, maybe so. But Bathurst, 1998, but they did a demo there at the touring car round in 96.
A staged demo.
Yeah, demo. Yeah. I didn't say it was a competitive demo.
Yes.
The short oval at Adelaide International Raceway always was hosting those races. Of course, Bob controlled that as well. They went to Barbagallo very late in the piece, like 99, 2000, I think they did an event over
early
there.
Early 2000.
And don't forget, they ran at Albert Park.
Yes.
At the Grand Prix. So you piece all those together, it wasn't just the Thunderdome. There was actually a pretty solid potential to put together a calendar. I mean, I know some of those tracks are not around anymore, Oran Park being the main one that's not there. But as a series, summer form of motorsport, perfect. Like it really hit the mark. And, you think of the name. I mean, I brought the list here. So NASCAR champions, once they started running an Australian championship, Robin Best won the first two, George Elliott, the Lumina. That's the car, isn't it, that's in the National Motor Racing Museum at Bathurst at the moment, or one very much like it.
It's a Monte Carlo now, but I think it did begin life as a Lumina.
Yeah, I think it might be that car that got rebodied later on down the track. But Max Dumsny, what a star he was at the Thunderdome. Mm. He won the 92-93 season. Remember that they ran across the summer season, so the way that you're a champion. You're a champion of the 92-93 year or the 93-94. Yes. So Barry Graham on the next year for John Sydney Racing again.
Well, talking about those two guys, we talked about all the touring car stars that came across and tried NASCAR, but all the speedway drivers, like Max, of course, is a legendary sprint car driver. Barry Graham, great on the ovals, yep. and of course turned that into a much bigger career over in the US with the Richard Petty Driving School.
Yeah, plenty of people went, you know, so lots of touring car blokes went to Oscar NASCAR.
Mm.
Lots of Oscar blokes stepped up to NASCAR. Lots of speedway blokes coming to NASCAR. There was a nice little kind of a this blend of all these different people from different backgrounds, and then you parachuted in some touring car big names, or a Kevin Schwantz came and had and started, you know, he was a regular part of the seasons here for a few years. The one-offs like a Greg Murphy or a Russell Ingall, Dick Johnson early in the piece ran a fair bit. Alan Grice was a Thunderdome NASCAR, Oscar regular over the years. You know, Brad Jones won the 94-95 NASCAR title after 5 years of winning Oscar in a row. Jim Richards won the title for Dick Midgley, the Canadian, and then Kim Jane went on a tear and won four in a row. Once he teamed up with John Sydney, he was hard to beat in that Bob Jane team arts Monte Carlo. And he was the last champ, the 99-2000 champ, and I think there was a planned meeting late 2000 that just didn't happen, and there were no Thunderdome races from there on, and the stock car series emerged out of it, but that was it. And you look at the Oscar champions, I'm pretty sure – that they did crown Tony Kavich as the first Oscar champion, which is kind of forgotten about. Mm. But it was the first form of racing to race on the Thunderdome itself, because the NASCARs are on the same bill, but they race later on in the event. Brad Jones won four titles in a row when he buggered off. That opened it up for Marshall J. Brewer. He was a touring car bloke from years earlier. Marshall ran the fast track racing school there at the Thunderdome. So many people, me included, went for rides or drove those cars over the years. Terry Wyhoon won the next year, then went to NASCAR. Matthew White won the next year, went to NASCAR. And both of those guys in supercars when the V8 Live. See, that was the thing. The thing that was Darren McDonald and Lee Watkins. So Ford never won the Oscar series until the last year, 98-99 season.
Yeah.
And then the Bathurst Tourers and Future Tour thing kind of evolved out of what Oscar was. But that was the opportunity for Oscar to live on as future tourers, Bathurst tourers, the Bruce Williams Junior Tour category that kind of was very good thought process to take Oscar racing that was kind of slipping, a cost-controlled junior-level Ford and Holden category. But, of course, you had Evesco trying to push the development series through to give their old cars a place to go, and they kind of squashed them out of the way along the way and probably won a few political arm wrestles along the way too. So,
see, if Oscar had made that move 5 years earlier, around 92-93, to start racing more road courses and not act more independent of NASCAR, the NASCAR category, but position itself as much a road racing category as an oval racing category, maybe that 90s looks a bit different with how... Yeah,
interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder how many of the competitor base, though, that you would have ticked off who were really geared to running Thunderdome and ovals, and the road course racing was sort of the extra bits rather than the norm. But I'm interested to know, and I'd love to sit down with some of those people involved and talk about their views on what could have happened or what should have happened, or could it have just not been avoided that it just ended up going where it did and it ended up winding up. And, you know, that Thunderdome circuit not running anymore. It's just sitting out there. It reminded me, actually, I watched that series recently with Dale Earnhardt Jr., the Lost Speedway series he's done on streaming in America. And it's built around him going to look at old speedways and the leftover ruins of them. A lot of dirt track stuff.
Hmm.
But I thought, geez, if he ever came to Australia, there's a perfect prime position for him to do a show at the Calder Park Thunderdome, because given the American and NASCAR connection, I reckon he'd be up for it. I reckon we should campaign. If he's going to do Series 2.
Yeah, come here.
Come and do Thunderdome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then do AIR.
Yeah. Well, no, it's still there, though. Like, it's
then go look at the one that was going to be at Lakeside.
Yeah, there was all sorts of chat about Darlington was the place that they were talking about another track being sort of put together.
And the Parramatta City Speedway short track that was going to be on a couple of occasions.
It needed another overall or two to really get the thing up and rolling, and it never quite got that far. But I really enjoy. I went to the Thunderdome a lot in the mid-late 90s of a Saturday night with the motorsport news guys, and quite often just watching rather than reporting. And just I can just vividly remember just the reverberation of those great, the noise, you know, a howling field of 30 OS cars firing down into that first corner. You know, you only needed 15 or so NASCARs to really get your attention when they echoed out of that final turn.
Yeah.
You know, the sound of 50 HQs just just pegged the whole way around until someone had the proverbial shunt that set off 25 of them upside down and around the corners.
When someone decided to make it four wide.
Yeah, it didn't work. Jeez, they wrecked some shit.
Yeah.
Man, lucky that so many of those guys got out of some of those shunts because there was some pretty massive ones. Remember, too, though, that they tried to Australianize NASCAR. I reckon that was a mistake. Remember that they bodied NASCARs as Commodores and Falcons. Kind of the theory, I reckon, was right. They were trying to Oscarize NASCAR to make it a bit more familiar to the Australian fan of a Commodore and a Falcon NASCAR, and it didn't really catch on, though.
I thought that was a great idea, though. Like, and I'm honestly surprised that it didn't catch on so well, because I don't know whether it was a question of the car, the body styles they came up with not being as competitive with
the existing. Well, Gricey won in a Commodore.
He did, but he was the only one.
Yeah, pretty much. Probably didn't have the biggest teams running them or the most dominant cars.
And the Falcon was just flat, never on the pace.
Yeah, you're right. It was the right idea because you needed to capture the attention of the local audience and market. And
there weren't Commodores and V8 Commodores and Falcons racing anywhere else in circuit racing categories. You think the production cars at that point were V6s.
Yeah, not a good
straight
noise.
Straight sixes, yeah.
Yeah, not a good noise.
Entertaining racing, but not a great noise.
Yeah. So I think that was one of those. That's an interesting element when you think back on whether that theory was good. The theory was good, but you know, could the Australian public identify with a Chevy Lumina or a Pontiac Grand Prix or a Ford Thunderbird or a – was it NASCAR if it didn't – like we had Oscar. So don't try to Australianise the NASCAR thing because it's NASCAR.
But what better storyline is there than an Australian product beating all the American products?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Maybe – I don't know, but I think Holden were quite behind it because they – there was Holden-wise sponsorship. There was, you know, lots of PR going on at the time.
I'd like to see what would happen if that went in, if the Commodore NASCAR went into a wind tunnel with a Pontiac Grand Prix or a Chevy Lumen, just to see just how close to the money it was, because I can't help but feel maybe it wasn't.
Yeah, not sure. I have to ask people who were more in the know and more involved in it than
requires a bit of sleuth
than us. But it makes me actually think that there's great parallels. I mean, you can always learn stuff from history.
Totally.
So I look back and go. And a really interesting piece that our colleague Mark Walker wrote recently on the Race Talk website, Richard Crail's website that he does a lot of work on, looking at the price of secondhand NASCAR, like relatively new NASCAR chassis out of the States, you pick it up for seriously $2.50 in a can of Coke.
If only that were an exaggeration. It's incredible.
It's pretty similar.
Yeah.
Probably a slab of Coke and you a few extra cans and you'd pick up a chassis.
The historic cars are very expensive, but the current ones, yeah.
Yeah. Like, why would it – like, here's a weird one. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to you about this off air. If I was going to run a racing series in Australia and I had a bunch of money, which we know is not going to happen, so I can talk about it.
Not you personally.
Anyone's money if they wanted me to spend it for them. If I was going to go and set up a car racing series – the first thing I would do would be to ring NASCAR and do a licensing deal for an Australian NASCAR championship to run on road courses. Because if the fans fall out of favour in supercars land and they're not liking what they're getting served up there, serve them up the same but better or different. Look at what the people did on the Gold Coast a few years ago when they wheeled out that Penske Pennzoil, was it a Fusion, Ford Fusion, whatever it was?
Yeah.
People frothed. People lost their minds when McLaughlin and Coulthard drove out in that thing. Made noise. It slipped and slid. It had attitude. Hello. That'd be good value. Yeah. And I'm not saying specific. I mean, they're going the right way. Their new gen NASCAR for 2022 is becoming more like a supercar than the previous generation of cars are with
six gears and our old transaxle.
The center lock wheel nuts, even the refueling via a hose rather than the churns.
Yeah.
They're bringing it up into the next era and some of the dark age technology out of the way. wouldn't it make sense to capitalize on some either what's been changed out of their world and cheap, or step in with them and be on the same pathway and share in some of the costings and some of the possibilities and technology and supply? I mean, when NASCAR racing in Australia was up and running, blokes were going to the States and buying, you know, there's piles of stuff over there to buy for a decent price that you'd run all year. Motors, gearboxes, all sorts of chassis. I mean, some blokes built their own cars here using what they learnt from over there.
Mm.
But, maybe it's a pipe dream, but I could see if you were going to set up something that appeals to the Australian fans, it's got to be V8s, it's got to be loud, it's got to grab their attention and their focus. Can it be more cost effective than what's currently being proposed or looked at for next year in supercars?
That is the big question mark, because that's ultimately what determines the viability of something
and
like that.
And that's why this worked last time.
Yeah.
Going Group A touring car racing and the cost versus the exposure and the like, or going NASCAR, Oscar racing versus the exposure. If you took what Brad and Kim Jones spent on their Oscar in 1991, 1990, 91, 92, Cooper Tools, Castrol era, versus what sponsorship money they got, prize money they got, and what it cost them to race, and the television exposure value, why would you go touring car racing?
Yeah.
If you could come up with all those elements a little bit better or a little bit different or a little bit – I'm just saying, it's what I'd be – I'm not going to do it. I'm not in a position to do it. But if you were going to have a crack at something, I think that would be the sort of thing that would be – now, I'm not saying they'd go racing at Thunderdome again. One of the most common questions we get
– look, if you've got all the money –
there's a lot of money to fix that joint up. But, yeah, you'd need some form of an oval somewhere along the line somehow.
Welcome back, AIR.
Yeah, well, just patch it up and, maybe we
– sure, they could build a short track out at the bend. It's got everything else.
Well, I was going to say it wouldn't be that hard.
Yeah.
I mean
– QR?
QR is basically an oval. QR, you could actually just use that link road off turn three to turn six and there you go. You've virtually got a short – I don't know what it is, one point something or other K – roundy section. So,
sorry, did you organise the thunderstorm for the Thunderdome podcast?
No, it is a thunderstorm brewing, and you can probably hear it in the background. So, it's very appropriate. Yeah. I didn't even think that we had that much power to be able to control this stuff.
Another job for Bob.
I tell you one thing too, Terry Sawyer.
Oh yes,
she was a star absolutely. Of Oscar. She won the first ever Oscar race.
Yeah.
One in NASCAR as well.
Yep.
And now you never see or hear of her.
She'd be a great person to talk to on the podcast just to
where is she?
Because I know I came to you a few years ago when I was at Fox because the anniversary of her victory. So she won the third round of the 1990-91 series.
In NASCAR. Yeah.
Only woman to win a NASCAR race for NASCAR spec cars anywhere in the world. And that's a stat that I'm pretty sure still exists today.
That has not been beaten, surely.
No, I think ARCA races or definitely lower ladder, maybe an Xfinity race. Well, I can't remember off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure Terry Sawyer still holds that record. She was a gun.
Yeah, and now she probably disappeared not long after that, early 90s.
Well, that was her last full-time season.
Yeah, right.
Because
I'd love to know. She went to the States, I think, as well.
Briefly, yeah.
Yeah, and I reckon, when people talk about the best Australian female racing drivers in history.
She's right up there.
Well, she never gets mentioned.
No.
Leanne Tander, for sure.
Yep.
Chrissy Gibson, for sure. But Terry Sawyer's got to be in the conversation there somewhere. What she did back in those days of Oscar NASCAR was damn impressive.
It was not just the wins, but she was consistently competitive throughout her years in Oscar.
Yeah, absolutely.
And ran the 05.
And she did too.
Yeah.
Big .05.
.05.
Which, of course, the drink driving blood alcohol limit in Victoria, which that's what Brock started with. And Terry Sawyer, that's right. She ran 05 on a VL Commodore and I think maybe on a NASCAR for a brief time. I think the car she would drive, it was like a purple and silver
Bob Jane team car.
Pontiac,
number one.
I think it might have been. Number one, yeah, that's right. We've got a lot of Thunderdome photos in the files here at work from the late 80s to the early mid-90s. So probably runs out about 92, 93. But if anyone out there's got photo archives as a fan or you might have been semi-pro or you used to shoot, particularly from the mid-90s onwards through to the end, let us know. Drop us a line. I'd... I'd love to talk to you and love to acquire your photo collection. So
I would like to offer the photos that we took at the one race meeting we went to, but alas, it turned out there was no film in the camera. So so yeah.
Whose fault was that?
Who knows?
Oh, okay. Oh, well, happens in the big jobs. It was a style of racing, wasn't it, where a privateer could run well, source your bits from America, do some of your own work, get your mates to be a pit crew.
It was an achievable form of motorsport.
Yeah, club racing's not the term, but it was accessible.
Yeah.
But it was still at a high sort of a level. Yeah. I reckon it was one of those things that if you go back through I haven't done it for a long time, but if you go back through the magazines of the period, a lot of column inches to Oscar NASCAR racing, Auto Action, Motorsport News had regular sections. There was cars being built. There was new competitors coming in. You had and they had the flow. So a lot of Oscar blokes did their Oscar thing. They stepped up to NASCAR.
Mm.
Once Oscar got big and they'd moved to the new model cars, the older model Commodores and Falcons were sort of the DVS series of the day. Sportsman,
yeah.
New series off
Formula
those cars
Falcon,
going. Yeah, Formula Falcon, that didn't really go very far, did it?
No, wasn't heaps, but yeah, it was still a thing.
Yeah. It had nice progression. You saw people go up and down the ladder into the different categories when they got, you know, sufficiently successful in one. They were able to get the better sponsorship opportunity and not just the money Bob Jane spent to build the joint, put up the prize money, but he found ways to sponsor people and his logo's popped up in all sorts of places on all sorts of cars. Now, whether he was paying for all of them, I don't know, but maybe he had some deals going on left, right and centre. But
wasn't it Brad Jones that tells a story about running into Alan Mance of Alan Mance Holden dealership, who was on the sides of his Oscar
for a time.
And, Alan Mance wasn't actually paying for that sponsorship.
He knew nothing about it. Brad Jones is on my list for this year, and I want to get up to Albury soon before the Supercars Championship really lights up to sit down and talk a lot of Oscar NASCAR with him. I looked at this and thought, we've mentioned some of these big names that took on the Thunderdome and Oscar NASCAR racing, and I just wanted to run through a couple of them quickly. Obviously, we mentioned Brock, Jim Richards.
Oh,
I mean, man, he was in that first race in 88 in the Foster's Oldsmobile. He won the Aussie title in NASCAR, as I mentioned. Remember, he drove the Stillwell Falcon. He was one of the first Falcons to tackle the Commodores.
First Falcon.
Yeah, I think he was the first, wasn't he?
Yeah.
On the dome. He took on NASCAR's best at Suzuka in Japan. If you haven't listened to his episode from our podcast in when did we do that one? In 2019.
Mm.
He talks about racing at Suzuka and meeting Dale Earnhardt.
Yeah.
That was great. You and I sat there with our jaws on the ground. If you haven't heard it, go back through our back catalogue because we've actually got a fair back catalogue now.
This is number 87.
Yeah. I think 87 is a good number for the Thunderdome. Wasn't the year that it was officially opened?
Correct. That's when officially opened when Richard Petty came out and did tyre testing.
There's a good point. I've got the photos. Got the photos somewhere. The King never raced at the Dome, but he was part of a group of drivers. I think Bobby Hillen was
Bobby
another
Hillen
one of them.
And Rodney Combs.
Yeah, they came out and did the Goodyear tyre testing with some of those John Shepherd-built cars, mid-87. Yeah, good point. The King never quite made it here, and the Intimidator didn't either. But there was some chat a few times that he was going to come for one of those Christmas races.
Same with Bill Elliott,
$1
Bill.
It didn't come up. But you think back, I'm jumping the topic here, but February 88, that very first one, wasn't that like 2 weeks after the Daytona 500?
Yep, and Neil Bonnett was in the middle of a winning streak. I think it was the only race that he'd won, because in NASCAR in the US at the time, there was a big tire war going on between Goodyear, the incumbent, and Hoosier, who was made speedway tires for lower levels but stepped up to NASCAR. And the Hoosiers for various events were the tires to be on, and Bonnett won a whole heap of races with Braymock at the start of that season. The only one he won on Goodyears was here.
Because that's what you had to run on.
Yeah, that's all they had.
Yeah. So had he won Daytona that year?
Nah, I think he was top five though.
But Allison had
Bobby won. Bobby Allison had won the Daytona 500, so, beating his son Davey.
Yes, that's right. So I think that was 2 weeks before Calder.
About that,
So get your head around it. Just imagine now that in 2021, that's akin to this year in mid-February, having an all-in race between some of the top stars of supercars or touring cars, and, you know, it's Will Davison and it's and it's Jamie Wincup and it's Mark Winterbottom and it's
they're battling all these Chase Elliott, going Joey up against Logano.
Chase Elliott and Joey Logano and Brad Keselowski coming out and running here, who are then in 2 weeks' time going to go back and run the Daytona 500. That's kind of like what it was.
Yeah.
The natural equivalent then and now. Alan Grice, we talked to Grice on the podcast late last year, some quotable quotes from his time racing NASCAR. First Australian to qualify for the World 600 at Charlotte in 87, and he and Bob Jane and Foster's got together.
Not the first Australian to race in NASCAR, but the first to qualify for the World 600.
Who was the first, by the way?
You would think I'd have found that one out before launching into that correction. I think Frank Gardner was one of the first, if not the first.
Yeah, he was. He ran, and I've got it here because I thought this might come in handy. He ran a Ford for Holman Moody in 68 at Rockingham.
Yeah.
The American 500, a very originally titled name. I'd love to go back through some of the race titles of the races at the Thunderdome. We had a Moomba 200, remember, there for a while.
Christopher Dean will never forget it.
He never made it into it. Well, Larry Perkins didn't because he was supposed to be driving that car.
Larry Perkins scratched.
Christopher Dean ended
up in the fence. An ice skater ruined his car.
Yeah, yeah. That's not many other people can say that.
What a sentence that is.
The time the ice skater rode off my Oscar.
Strange but true.
Well, it wasn't his Oscar. I think it was Kim James from memory. But Frank Gardner finished 30, started 21st, lasted two laps of the 500, had an engine issue and was classified 44th. So I'm not sure if he was a start and park there. Grand sum, prize money won, $515 US, according to my information. Dick Johnson.
Yep.
Went to the States, called Richard Petty a prick on TV.
Worked with a future NASCAR Hall of Famer, Ray Evenham.
You talked to Ray Evenham, didn't you?
A couple of years ago,
about racing with Dick and prepping his cars?
Because Ray Evenham was a top modified driver in his own right, an absolute gun driver, but was also heavily involved in the International Race of Champions program, the IROC series for Roger Penske, that essentially used NASCAR type car, stock car type cars, but carrying Chevy Camaro bodywork. And he'd never actually gone into NASCAR or Winston Cup until Dick Johnson and Ross Palmer and Welded Tube Company and Bob Gayden came along to say,
He came out to Australia, though, and ran cars here to help him.
Yeah, yeah.
And then
so that the 88 Christmas meeting was the first time that they'd worked together.
And they had a shunted car when Dick was in that big pileup.
That was February.
That was the first one. That's right.
Yeah. And then early 89, Dick announced that he was going to go do five races, and Ray Evenham went and built a couple of cars out of New Jersey.
And didn't
not exactly NASCAR territory.
One of those cars popped up, though, didn't they, in the years that followed?
I don't know if they both came back here, but one certainly came back here because Bruce Partington ran that car originally in the same original red coat livery, just with the
different
the sponsors taken off.
And stuff, yep.
And one of them has eventually popped back up in the States because Ray Evenham bought it.
Fair point.
Yeah. Later on sold it, but it was verified as the car. I think it was WTC02 chassis number.
There you go.
Yeah,
it's really cool. Of course, Ray Evenham, for those who are not listening, was crew chief for Jeff Gordon for multiple NASCAR Winston Cup titles with the Rainbow Warriors, the DuPont Chevys of Hendrick Motorsport in the mid '90s when they really just went on a tear. And these days, he's got all sorts of. He's doing a lot of car restorations and car preparation and historic racing, and he's involved with a new series with Tony Stewart that Mark Webber's going to drive. And it's like a made for TV
for the new generation.
It's kind of like made for TV stock car sort of racing series with a bunch of all sorts of drivers, and Webber's signed up to do it. So hasn't been much written about it in Australia, probably. So, but Ray Evenham would be a great guest. We'd love to pick his brain about his time in NASCAR in Australia and with Dick and then some of the other stuff. He had a great TV show.
Americana.
Yeah. You see it here on cable, on Foxtel occasionally. I haven't seen it for a long time, but was a really cool series. I like what he does. He was standing in the media center at the Indy Speedway when I was there. When did I go there last for the 100th running? Was it a couple of years ago? And I went to introduce myself to him because I was going to ask him if he had 5 minutes to have a chat on tape recorder so I could do maybe a story about racing with Dick Johnson and all that stuff. And he was busy watching cars on carb day and he got taken away with something else and I sort of missed my opportunity. So maybe one day. Is Brad Jones king of the Thunderdome is my next question.
It's hard to see who would be if he wasn't.
If he wasn't, who is or was? Jim Richards, Max Dumsny, Kim Jane.
There's an argument for Barry Graham.
Yep.
Oh, Kim Jane won so many titles.
He won four titles, but I reckon the last few of those, the competition level wasn't as high. But not to take anything away from it.
No.
But
that kind of illustrates just how extensive Brad Jones' dominance of both categories was. Well,
he didn't really dominate NASCAR. He did. I think he competed in NASCAR in the same season that he did his last Oscar. He did some of the races. He popped up a little bit.
Mm.
But then he made the swap. And I think his first
94-95 was his first full-time NASCAR season.
Which he won the title in.
Yeah, he definitely wasn't an Oscar at that point.
No, which was the Atlantis Removals Luna.
The white car, yeah.
Yeah, and they called their cars a few different names. There was an Elroy and there was a Jetson, I think, and there was Bubba, I think there was another one. And I saw that he's still got all the chassis files up there at BJR in Albury.
Excellent. I like hearing that
sort of thing. I looked through them when I was up there a few years ago looking at Audi stuff. So
they got an ex-Jeff Gordon car at some point, so I'd like to know what... It was in the US.
It was a Dupont car from memory,
yes,
wasn't it?
Yeah. It was.
Must go back through all the old magazines and see what we can find, because I'm not sure that remember that it was Oscar Racing that was the sanctioning body from 1990, 91, somewhere around there. Has any of the paperwork or record keeping? I've seen cars that are online for sale with the Oscar Racing ID plate and things like that.
Same.
Where's
yeah.
the records of all those cars, or were there logbooks, or were there?
I sincerely hope they exist somewhere.
I get the feeling that they don't. And if they do, maybe Rodney Jane has them all tucked away somewhere, or they got thrown out, or I don't know. Yeah. But
if anyone does know, you know where we are.
Let us know. Of course, we don't have to name names or give out information, but if there was a way to be able, if that stuff did exist and it's being locked away, or if it's been going to wreck and ruin, we'd love to make sure that it survives for motor racing history. Because I think there are some cars that would be worth a bit of money. Like they're cars that are collectible and they did good things in a form of the sport that shouldn't be forgotten. Because I think it was pretty cool. We also saw Jeff Brabham briefly.
Very briefly.
Briefly do NASCAR. Did a deal to race for the Ian Thomas, what was it, the Tropic Coast team or the Bright Eye Sunglasses
That's
car.
Yep.
But had a BMW Super Tourer contract, and BMW in Germany said, no way, you're doing a NASCAR thing. So I think he started the first lap of one of the races, got out, and Max Dumsny got in. And under the unique NASCAR rule book that we carried over here, the guy that starts the race
gets the points
even if he didn't do any of the work. Yeah. The relief driver could drive 99% of the laps and doesn't get it. So that sort of is a way to bring Jeff Brabham in the conversation.
That reminds me, another guy that we haven't actually touched on, Charlie O'Brien.
He was good.
Yeah,
NASCAR and Oscar.
NASCAR
Gold
and
Coast,
Oscar.
Thunderdome, BP Visco Ford Thunderbird.
That's
I remember when
one.
That rolled out. That looked sensational.
Yeah.
Another guy we need to chat to at some point.
And he ran Greg Hansford in selected races. And Greg Hansford won a NASCAR race.
Did he? On the dome?
No.
Gold Coast.
A race that was, I believe, red flagged after about four laps because of rain. But he still won
it. Yeah. I think back to those early Gold Coast races and remember the vision. I don't know who it was. There's a car park. There used to be a
Walter Giles at
the first chicane.
Sorry, Steve Cosson over the top of Walter Giles.
Yeah, Walter Giles has spun and parked in the sand for I don't know how many laps.
Mm.
Steve Cosson comes down with no brakes, out of control, launches off the curb, is Dukes a Hazzard midair as he wipes the front off the parked Walter Giles car and fires out the other side.
Yeah.
It's probably on YouTube somewhere. It was back in the Channel 9 days of Gold Coast Indy.
And Walter was still in the car and was about to get out. Because he'd been there for a couple of laps.
He probably thought he was all right to get out by that stage. And remember, he built a Holden Calibra?
There's
a Calibra NASCAR?
Yeah. And then went on to work in the US.
He worked with Ambrose for a time too as his crew chief.
Yeah.
Briefly for a period there. I mentioned Russell Ingall earlier. He won the Bathurst 98 2-litre support race on the Saturday. But he also did a bit of Thunderdome racing.
Mm.
Had a third and a fourth on his debut run late in 98, I think it was. Maybe early 99. Greg Murphy took that car over from him. When he stopped driving in it, did a bit of Thunderdome racing. Here's one you will have forgotten. Paul Dumbrell.
Yes.
Raced and rode off an NASCAR, leased from John Faulkner and Albert Park in 99.
There you go.
Yeah.
He drove a lot of different things.
He had to go at a lot of stuff before he was even 18. Yeah. Alan Jones tested NASCAR at Thunderdome but never actually raced.
As did Andrew Medecki. Same
he
car.
Yeah, he did. Wayne Gardner raced a NASCAR, finished third, I think, in Terry Byers' spare car in 93.
Yes, end of 93.
Yep.
And it was meant to be The promotional deal then was it was going to be Gardner versus Kevin Schwantz. But then Lucky Strike found out Schwantz was going to try and race in that car. Because
he was still racing bikes at the time, wasn't he? Yeah,
he was the new world champion.
Oh, yeah, in 93 he won the title for Suzuki, didn't he?
Yeah.
Off-season, come on, give it a break. Riding a bike was probably far more dangerous than racing a car. But remember, when he did get to run, he won at Oran Park. First time out in 94 in the Pepsi Lumina. So, and he had the number 34, his famous number on the NASCAR. He did, 3 years of that in Australia? That,
yeah, and then he went and did a bunch of Busch Grand National races in the States, but never really kicked on with it.
He did fill in, I think, in Oscar for Bruce Williams one time too, from memory.
Yes, he did.
I think was that the period when Bruce was suspended by Bob Jayne? I'll have to ask him that because we're going to get him on the podcast.
Yes.
I really want to talk to him about future tours and Bathurst tours and Oscar and all that stuff because he was a regular competitor on the Dome. Charlie O'Brien, you mentioned. One of the things I forgot about Charlie that I got in my notes here, he actually had a crack at a Winston Cup race at Sonoma in 94. But didn't qualify. I'm not sure the car he was driving was up to scratch or terribly flash. But he won at the inaugural Gold Coast Indy in 91.
Yeah, he swept the Oscar and the NASCAR categories and earned himself $40,000.
Pretty good effort. Hansford, you mentioned. Phil Brock, split pin, did a bit of both Oscar and NASCAR. Win Percy had a bit of a dip at the Dome in NASCAR in early 89. Remember, he was supposed to be driving touring cars that year for the Holden Racing Team, but was the Holden Racing Team that wasn't that year and didn't do any touring car racing. Larry Perkins, we mentioned, he was supposed to do...
He qualified for an Oscar race.
Sixth for the Moomba 200 in March 89, but never made it to the 100-lap race because Christopher Dean, the skating superstar, if you're around in the late 80s, early 90s, Torval and Dean, Jane Torval, Christopher Dean, they were... Olympic gold medalists, weren't they?
Sarajevo,
Winter Olympics, and then became a dancing troupe around the world with ice dancing, and
then he triple axled it into the wall.
Yes, he did.
Hurt himself too. They actually had to cancel a bunch of appearances.
Yeah, fair point too. Crunching a wall like that would be making you pretty sore. Peter Fitzgerald, I forgot he did Oscar.
Yes, he did
too.
Goodyear
Commodore that later became the Falcon Tires Commodore. And that car later became the James Brock Auto Art Commodore that won that Bathurst Tourist 300.
Yes.
The first of what became future tourists. John Bow.
Yep.
Motorcraft Falcon and Oscar.
Yes, and christened the Thunderdome, as he told us when he came on our podcast.
He did. Episode one, our first ever episode. Have a listen. Our test day, I think he was the first one ever crash an NASCAR.
Yeah, or at the very least, apply a car to a wall.
Yeah, well... Near enough, same difference. Gary Rogers.
Call it a Thunderdome stripe, let's say.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, Gary Rogers was a gun at the Dome.
He was a regular in the Oscars. Of course, Steve Richards
got
in the Oscars there. Graham Crosby did a bit of NASCAR racing. Anyway, I'm naming all sorts of names. Gary Rush, remember, he was in that field for that first ever NASCAR race in the, I love this, the Repco Gold Star Engine Exchange Chevrolet.
Yes.
Got to love those long sponsor names from back in the day, don't you? But we didn't really answer. I think it's hard to go past Brad Jones as the king of the Thunderdome. I mean, five Oscar titles, a NASCAR title. We'd have to do the numbers to count up how many races he won there, but surely in that period as a percentage he won more than anybody else. Well, and if he didn't win, he was in the top two or three.
Well, that's it. I think he only did one more full-time season of NASCAR after his title win, and that, I think, is the only full season he did where he didn't win a title at the Thunderdome or in oval track form of racing.
It was very much the 2 liter stuff was pretty busy there for Audi, and the TV was starting to wane. Back to my earlier point, the TV for the Dome and the NASCAR Oscar wasn't up to the level it had previously been. So
that is probably another good point to make, that Mike Raymond did a lot to try and encourage or to help ease Australian audiences into NASCAR racing. You think of the amount of times NASCAR highlights, race reviews and wraps were shown during touring car racing broadcasts. I think like a half hour cut down of the World 600 was shown in 86.
He did it.
And then that, of course, translated into all the coverage NASCAR racing at the Thunderdome got.
He did so much. Yeah. He did so much. And if you're a fan of Mike, who's sadly no longer with us, have a listen to our podcast with Andy Raymond. We spoke to his son late last year and he had some great stories. And I really enjoyed that chat too, because there's so many things to talk about. And Mike was a big part of not just Seven Motorsport, but obviously, Thunderdome and NASCAR, Oscar in those early years. Seven was the host broadcaster and got on board and made it large. Yeah, I'm going with Brad. He's the king of the Dome, but there's a couple of others who would certainly have a rightful spot on the podium to to go alongside with that. It's sad that the venue is no longer there, but I think it's one of those, or it's there, but it's not there, if you know what I mean. It's not an active.
It's a shell of its former self.
Yeah, it's not an active facility.
Yeah.
We get asked a lot by fans, you know, are they going to restart? I don't see it ever restarting.
It's probably further away now than it ever has been.
Yeah, totally. And it's, I think it's important though to know where you've come from and what you've done and what the sport's done, not so much just to help shape the future, but I think what occurred out of that facility for the best part of 10 years and everything that was around it is a very special and unique part of Australian motor racing history, and one that I know 20 years, 25 years down the track now, absence makes the heart grow fonder, doesn't it? And sometimes you don't know what you had till you don't have it. Saturday nights at the Thunderdome were fantastic. I really enjoyed it. And I know so many of our listeners will have Thunderdome and NASCAR, Oscar-related stories, whether they crewed for a mate or they used to go out there and spend time at the facility as a spectator. So I reckon one day, I know we've got enough projects on, but I reckon we need to
collate. There's always room for more.
Yeah, we need to collate and build the history of NASCAR, Oscar in Australia.
We absolutely
have the winner, the list of, here's the roll of honour of all the champions. Here's who won the most races and the breakdown of races and poles and lap records and all of that stuff I reckon needs to be done with some amazing photography from over the years. We'll get around to it. We've got a few books on our plate for this year, but I reckon it's one that's a definite must do. But thoroughly enjoyed having a look back at Thunderdome, NASCAR, Oscar. I'm sure we've only scraped the surface, but it gives you a bit of a flavour of a cool period of the sport. I reckon we could do it again another time.
For sure. Let's rope someone in to join us for the next one.
Let's rope someone in. I'll launch some Oscar NASCAR flavoured chat into some of the chats that we've got planned for upcoming episodes. So I hope you've enjoyed the look back. Keep your suggestions coming over the course of the year of categories or topics that you'd like us to maybe do a feature episode on. We've done Super Touring, Super 2, Super Speedway now. Anything starts with S or another letter, we will open it up to other things. By all means, get in touch with us. You know where to find us. Our social media, you'll find us Facebook, Insta, Twitter. Through the website, there's a contact form there as well. Again, thank you very much for listening. We're off and rolling for 2021. The V8 Sleuth podcast is off and firing. We'll be back to have another chat to you in a week's time.